characterized by redness, swelling, and immune system activation, caused cells to proliferate, leading to the outgrowth of malignant cells. He was almost right. Chronic inflammation, smoldering over decades, does cause cancer. Chronic hepatitis virus infection in the liver precipitates liver cancer. But Fierko missed the essence of the cause. Inflammation makes cells divide in response to injury, but this cell division is driven as a reaction to an external agent, such as a bacteria or a wound. In cancer, the cell acquires autonomous proliferation. It is driven to divide by an internal signal. Fierko attributed cancer to the disturbed physiological milieu around the cell. He failed to fathom that the true disturbance lay within the cancer cell itself. 200 miles south of Fierko's Berlin laboratory, Walter Fleming, a biologist working in Prague, tried to uncover the cause of abnormal cell division, although using salamander eggs rather than human cells as his subject. To understand cell division, Fleming had to visualize the inner anatomy of the cell. In 1879, Fleming thus stained dividing salamander cells with aniline, the all-purpose chemical dye used by Paul Ehrlich. The stain highlighted a blue, thread-like substance located deep within the cell's nucleus that condensed and brightened to a cerulean shade just before cell division. Fleming called his blue-stained structures chromosomes, colored bodies. He realized that cells from every species had a distinct number of chromosomes. Humans have 46. Salamanders have 14. Chromosomes were duplicated during cell division and divided equally between the two daughter cells, thus keeping the chromosome number constant from generation to generation of cell division. But Fleming could not assign any further function to these mysterious blue, colored bodies in the cell. Had Fleming moved his lens from salamander eggs to Fierko's human specimens, he might have made the next crucial conceptual leap in understanding the root abnormality in cancer cells. It was Fierko's former assistant, David Paul von Hansemann, following Fleming's and Fierko's trails, who made a logical leap between the two. Examining cancer cells stained with aniline dyes with a microscope, von Hansemann noticed that Fleming's chromosomes were markedly abnormal in cancer. The cells had split, frayed, disjointed chromosomes, chromosomes broken and rejoined, chromosomes in triplets and quadruplets. Von Hansemann's observation had a profound corollary. Most scientists continued to hunt for parasites in cancer cells. Bennett's theory of spontaneous suppuration still held a macabre fascination for some pathologists. But von Hansemann proposed that the real abnormality lay in the structure of these bodies internal to cancer cells, in chromosomes, and therefore in the cancer cell itself. But was it cause or effect? Had cancer altered the structure of chromosomes? Or had chromosomal changes precipitated cancer? Von Hansemann had observed a correlation between chromosomal change and cancer. What he needed was an experiment to causally connect the two. The missing experimental link emerged from the lab of Theodor Boveri, yet another former assistant of Fierko's. Like Fleming, who worked with salamander cells, Boveri chose to study simple cells in simple organisms, eggs from sea urchins, which he collected on the windswept beaches near Naples. Urchin eggs, like most eggs in the animal kingdom, are strictly monogamous. Once a single sperm has entered the egg puts up an instant barrier to prevent others from entering. After fertilization, the egg divides, giving rise to two, then four cells, each time duplicating the chromosomes and splitting them equally between the two daughter cells. To understand this natural chromosomal separation, Boveri devised a highly unnatural experiment. Rather than allowing the urchin egg to be fertilized by just one sperm, he stripped the outer membrane of the egg with chemicals and forcibly fertilized the egg with two sperms. The multiple fertilization, Boveri found, precipitated chromosomal chaos. Two sperms fertilizing an egg results in three of each chromosome, a number impossible to divide evenly. The urchin egg, unable to divide the number of chromosomes appropriately among its daughter cells, was thrown into frantic internal disarray. The rare cell that got the right combination of all 36 sea urchin chromosomes developed normally. Cells that got the wrong combinations of chromosomes failed to develop, or aborted development and involuted and died. Chromosomes, Boveri concluded, must carry information vital to the proper development and growth of cells. This conclusion allowed Boveri to make a bold, if far-fetched, conjecture about the core abnormality in cancer cells. Since cancer cells possessed striking aberrations in chromosomes, Boveri argued that these chromosomal abnormalities might be the cause of the pathological growth characteristic of cancer. Boveri found himself circling back to Galen, to the age-old notion that all cancers were connected by a common abnormality, the unitary cause of carcinoma, as Boveri called it. Cancer was not an unnatural group of different maladies, Boveri wrote. Instead, a common feature lurked behind all cancers, a uniform abnormality that emanated from abnormal chromosomes, and was therefore internal to the cancer cell. Boveri could not put his finger on the nature of this deeper internal abnormality, but the unitary cause of carcinoma lay in this disarray, not a chaos of black bile, but a chaos of blue chromosomes. Boveri published his chromosomal theory of cancer in an elegant scientific pamphlet entitled Concerning the Origin of Malignant Tumors in 1914. It was a marvel of fact, fantasy, and inspired guesswork that stitched sea urchins and malignancy into the same fabric. But Boveri's theory ran into an unanticipated problem, a hard, contradictory fact that it could not explain away. In 1910, 4 years before Boveri had published his theory, Peyton Rouse, working at the Rockefeller Institute, had demonstrated that cancer in chickens could be caused by a virus, soon to be named the Rouse sarcoma virus, or RSV. The central problem was this. As causal agents, Rouse's virus and Boveri's chromosomes were incompatible. A virus is a pathogen, an external agent, an invader exogenous to the cell. A chromosome is an internal entity, an endogenous structure buried deep inside the cell. The two opposites could not both claim to be the unitary cause of the same disease. How could an internal structure, a chromosome, and an external infectious agent, a virus, both create cancer? In the absence of concrete proof for either theory, a viral cause for cancer seemed far more attractive and believable. Viruses, initially isolated in 1898 as minuscule infectious microbes that caused plant diseases, were becoming increasingly recognized as causes for a variety of animal and human diseases. In 1909, a year before Rouse isolated his cancer-causing virus, Carl Landsteiner implicated a virus as the cause for polio. By the early 1920s, viruses that caused cowpox and human herpes infections had been isolated and grown in laboratories, further cementing the connection between viruses and human and animal diseases. Undeniably, the belief in cause was admixed with the hope for a cure. If the causal agent was exogenous and infectious, then a cure for cancer seemed more likely. Vaccination with cowpox, as Jenner had shown, prevented the much more lethal smallpox infection. And Rouse's discovery of a cancer-causing virus, albeit in chickens, had immediately provoked the idea of a therapeutic cancer vaccine. In contrast, Boveri's theory that cancer was caused by a mysterious problem lurking in the thread-like chromosomes stood on thin experimental evidence and offered no prospect for a cure. While the mechanistic understanding of the cancer cell remained suspended in limbo between viruses and chromosomes, a revolution in the understanding of normal cells was sweeping through biology in the early 20th century. The seeds of this revolution were planted by a retiring, nearsighted monk in the isolated hamlet of Brno, Austria, who bred pea plants as a hobby. In the early 1860s, working alone, Gregor Mendel had identified a few characteristics in his purebred plants that were inherited from one generation to the next. The color of the pea flower, the texture of the pea seed, the height of the pea plant. When Mendel intercrossed short and tall, or blue-flowering and green-flowering plants using a pair of minute forceps, he stumbled on a startling phenomenon. Short plants bred with tall plants did not produce plants of intermediate height. They produced tall plants. Wrinkle-seeded peas crossed with smooth-seeded peas produced only wrinkled peas. The implication of Mendel's experiment was far-reaching. Inherited traits, Mendel proposed, are transmitted in discrete, indivisible packets. Biological organisms transmit instructions from one cell to its progeny by transferring these packets of information. Mendel could only visualize these traits or properties in a descriptive sense, as colors, texture, or height moving from generation to generation. He could not see or fathom what conveyed this information from one plant to its progeny. His primitive lamp-lit microscope, with which he could barely peer into the interior of cells, had no power to reveal the mechanism of inheritance. Mendel did not even have the name for this unit of inheritance. Decades later, in 1909, botanists would christen it a gene. But the name was still just a name. It offered no further explanation about a gene's structure or function. Mendel's studies left a provocative question hanging over biology for half a century. In what corporal, physical form was a gene, the particle of inheritance, carried inside the cell? In 1910, Thomas Hunt Morgan, an embryologist at Columbia University in New York, discovered the answer. Like Mendel, Morgan was a compulsive breeder, but of fruit flies, which he raised by the thousands on rotting bananas in the fly room on the far edge of the Columbia campus. Again, like Mendel, Morgan discovered heritable traits moving indivisibly through his fruit flies generation upon generation, eye colors and wing patterns that were conveyed from parents to offspring without blending. Morgan made another observation. He noted that an occasional rare trait, such as white eye color, was intrinsically linked to the gender of the fly. White eyes were found only in male flies. But maleness, the inheritance of sex, Morgan knew, was linked to chromosomes. So genes had to be carried on chromosomes, the thread-like structures identified by Fleming three decades earlier. Indeed, a number of Fleming's initial observations on the properties of chromosomes began to make sense to Morgan. Chromosomes were duplicated during cell division, and genes were duplicated as well, and thus transmitted from one cell to the next, and from one organism to the next. Chromosomal abnormalities precipitated abnormalities in the growth and development of sea urchins, and so abnormal genes must have been responsible for this dysfunction. In 1915, Morgan proposed a crucial advance to Mendel's theory of inheritance. Genes were born on chromosomes. It was the transmission of chromosomes during cell division that allowed genes to move from a cell to its progeny. The third vision of the gene emerged from the work of Oswald Avery, a bacteriologist at the Rockefeller University in New York. Mendel had found that genes could move from one generation to the next. Morgan had proved that they did so by being carried on chromosomes. In 1926, Avery found that in certain species of bacteria, genes could also be transmitted laterally between two organisms, from one bacterium to its neighbor. Even dead, inert bacteria, no more than a conglomeration of chemicals, could transmit genetic information to live bacteria. This implied that an inert chemical was responsible for carrying genes. Avery separated heat-killed bacteria into their chemical components. And by testing each chemical component for its capacity to transmit genes, Avery and his colleagues reported in 1944 that genes were carried by one chemical, deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. What scientists had formerly disregarded as a form of cellular stuffing with no real function, a stupid molecule, as the biologist Max Delbruck once called it dismissively, turned out to be the central conveyor of genetic information between cells, the least stupid of all molecules in the chemical world. By the mid-1940s, 3 decades after biologists had coined the word, the molecular nature of the gene had come into focus. Functionally, a gene was a unit of inheritance that carried a biological trait from one cell to another, or from one generation to the next. Physically, genes were carried within the cell in the form of chromosomes. Chemically, genes were composed of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. But a gene only carries information. The functional, physical, and chemical understanding of the gene begged a mechanistic understanding. How did genetic information become manifest inside the cell? What did a gene do, and how? George Beadle, Thomas Morgan's student, switched from Morgan's fruit flies to an even more primitive organism, the slime mold, to answer these questions. Collaborating with the biochemist Edward Tatum at Stanford University in California, Beadle discovered that genes carried instructions to build proteins, complex, multidimensional macromolecules that were the workhorses of the cell. Proteins, researchers found in the 1940s, carry out the bulk of cellular functions. They form enzymes, catalysts that speed up biochemical reactions vital to the life of the cell. Proteins are receptors for other proteins or molecules, responsible for transmitting signals from one cell to the next. They can create structural components of the cell, such as the molecular scaffolding that allows a cell to exist in a particular configuration in space. They can regulate other proteins, thus creating minuscule circuits inside the cell, responsible for coordinating the life cycle of the cell. Beadle and Tatum found that a gene works by providing the blueprint to build a protein. A protein is a gene realized, the machine built from a gene's instructions. But proteins are not created directly out of genes. In the late 1950s, Jacques Monod and François Jacob, working in Paris, Sidney Brenner and Matthew Meselson at Caltech, and Francis Crick in Cambridge, discovered that the genesis of proteins from genes requires an intermediary step, a molecule called ribonucleic acid, or RNA. RNA is the working copy of the genetic blueprint. It is through RNA that a gene is translated into a protein. This intermediary RNA copy of a gene is called a gene's message. Genetic information is transmitted from a cell to its progeny through a series of discrete and coordinated steps. First, genes, located in chromosomes, are duplicated when a cell divides and are transmitted into progeny cells. Next, a gene in the form of DNA is converted into its RNA copy. Finally, this RNA message is translated into a protein. The protein, the ultimate product of genetic information, carries out the function encoded by the gene. An example borrowed from Mendel and Morgan helps illustrate the process of cellular information transfer. Red-eyed flies have glowering, ruby-colored eyes because they possess a gene that bears the information to build a red pigment protein. A copy of this gene is created every time a cell divides, and it thus moves from a fly to its egg cells, and then into the cells of the offspring fly. In the eye cells of the progeny fly, this gene is deciphered, i.e., converted into an intermediate RNA message. The RNA message, in turn, instructs the eye cells to build the red pigment protein, thus giving rise to red-eyed flies of the next generation. Any interruption in this information flow might disrupt the transmission of the red eye trait, producing flies with colorless eyes. This unidirectional flow of genetic information, DNA to RNA to protein, was found to be universal in living organisms, from bacteria to slime molds to fruit flies to humans. In the mid-1950s, biologists termed this the central dogma of molecular biology. An incandescent century of biological discovery, spanning from Mendel's discovery of genes in 1860 to Monod's identification of the RNA copy of genes in the late 1950s, illuminated the inner workings of a normal cell. But it did little to illuminate the workings of a cancer cell, or the cause of cancer, except in two tantalizing instances. The first came from human studies. 19th-century physicians had noted that some forms of cancer, such as breast and ovarian cancer, tended to run in families. This in itself could not prove a hereditary cause. Families share not just genes, but also habits, viruses, foods, exposures to chemicals, and neurotic behaviors. All factors, at some time or another, implicated as causes of cancer. But occasionally, a family history was so striking that a hereditary cause, and by extension a genetic cause, could not be ignored. In 1872, Hilario de Gouveia, a Brazilian ophthalmologist practicing in Rio, treated a young boy with a rare cancer of the eye called a retinoblastoma by removing the eye surgically. The boy had survived, grown up, and married a woman with no family history of cancer. The couple had several children, and two of the daughters developed their father's retinoblastoma in both eyes and died. De Gouveia reported this case as a puzzling enigma. He did not possess the language of genetics, but to later observers, the case suggested an inherited factor that lived in genes and caused cancer. But such cases were so rare that it was hard to test this hypothesis experimentally, and De Gouveia's report was largely ignored. The second time scientists circled around the cause of cancer, almost hitting the nerve spot of carcinogenesis, came several decades after the strange Brazilian case. In the 1910s, Thomas Hunt Morgan, the fruit fly geneticist at Columbia, noticed that mutant flies occasionally appeared within his flock of flies. In biology, mutants are defined as organisms that differ from the normal. Morgan noticed that an enormous flock of flies with normal wings might occasionally give birth to a monster with rough or scalloped wings. These mutations, Morgan discovered, were the results of alterations in genes, and the mutations could be carried from one generation to the next. But what caused mutations? In 1928, Hermann Josef Müller, one of Morgan's students, discovered that X-rays could vastly increase the rate of mutation in fruit flies. At Columbia, Morgan had produced mutant flies spontaneously. When DNA is copied during cell division, a copying error occasionally generates an accidental change in genes, thus causing mutations. Mueller found that he could accelerate the incidence of these accidents. Using X-rays to bombard flies, he found that he could produce hundreds of mutant flies over a few months, more than Morgan and his colleagues had produced using their vast breeding program over nearly two decades. The link between X-rays and mutations nearly led Morgan and Mueller to the brink of a crucial realization about cancer. Radiation was known to cause cancer. Recall Marie Curie's leukemia and the tongue cancers of the radium watch makers. Since X-rays also caused mutations in fruit fly genes, could cancer be a disease of mutations? And since mutations were changes in genes, could genetic alterations be the unitary cause of cancer? Had Mueller and Morgan, student and mentor, pitched their formidable scientific skills together, they might have answered this question and uncovered this essential link between mutations and malignancy. But once close colleagues, they became pitted and embittered rivals. Cantankerous and rigid with old age, Morgan refused to give Mueller full recognition for his theory of mutagenesis, which he regarded as a largely derivative observation. Mueller, in turn, was sensitive and paranoid. He felt that Morgan had stolen his ideas and taken an undue share of credit. In 1932, having moved his lab to Texas, Mueller walked into the nearby woods and swallowed a roll of sleeping pills in an attempted suicide. He survived, but haunted by anxiety and depression, his scientific productivity lapsed in his later years. Morgan, in turn, remained doggedly pessimistic about the relevance of the fruit fly work in understanding human diseases. In 1933, Morgan received the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for his far-reaching work on fruit fly genetics. Mueller would receive the Nobel Prize independently in 1946. But Morgan wrote self-deprecatingly about the medical relevance of his work. "The most important contribution to medicine that genetics has made is, in my opinion, intellectual." At some point far in the future, he imagined a convergence between medicine and genetics. Possibly, he speculated, the doctor may then want to call in his geneticist friends for consultation. But to oncologists in the 1940s, such a consultation seemed far-fetched. The hunt for an internal genetic cause of cancer had stalled since Boveri. Pathological mitosis was visible in cancerous tissue, but both geneticists and embryologists failed to answer the key question. What caused mitosis to turn so abruptly from such an exquisitely regulated process to chaos? More deeply, what had failed was a kind of biological imagination. Boveri's mind had so acrobatically leapt from sea urchins to carcinomas, or Morgan's from pea plants to fruit flies, in part because biology itself was leaping from organism to organism, finding systematic cellular blueprints that ran deeply through all the living world. But extending that same blueprint to human diseases had turned out to be a much more challenging task. At Columbia, Morgan had assembled a fair collection of fruit fly monsters, but none that even remotely resembled a real human affliction. The notion that the cancer doctor might call in a genetic friend to help understand the pathophysiology of cancer seemed laughable. Cancer researchers would return to the language of genes and mutations again in the 1970s. But the journey back to this language and to the true unitary cause of cancer would take a bewildering detour through the terrain of new biology and a further 50 years. Under the Lamps of Viruses. Unidentified flying objects, abominable snowmen, the Loch Ness Monster, and human cancer viruses. Medical World News, 1974, on four mysteries widely reported and publicized, but never seen. The biochemist Arthur Kornberg once joked that the discipline of modern biology in its early days often operated like the man in the proverbial story who is frantically searching for his keys under a street lamp. When a passerby asks the man whether he lost his keys at that spot, the man says that he actually lost them at home, but he is looking for the keys under the lamp because the light there is the brightest. In the pre-dawn of modern biology, experiments were so difficult to perform on biological organisms, and the results of manipulations so unpredictable, that scientists were severely constrained in their experimental choices. Experiments were conducted on the simplest model organisms, fruit flies, sea urchins, bacteria, slime molds, because the light there was the brightest. In cancer biology, Rouse's sarcoma virus represented the only such lamplit spot. Admittedly, it was a rare virus that produced a rare cancer in a species of chicken. Other cancer-causing viruses, such as SV40 and human papillomavirus, HPV, would eventually be discovered in 1960 and 1983, respectively. But it was the most reliable way to produce a real cancer in a living organism. Cancer researchers knew that X-rays, soot, cigarette smoke, and asbestos represented vastly more common risk factors for human cancers. They had heard of the odd Brazilian case of a family that seemed to carry retinoblastoma cancer in its genes. But the capacity to manipulate cancer in an experimental environment was unique to the Rouse virus, and so it stood center stage, occupying all the limelight. The appeal of studying Rouse virus was further compounded by the formidable force of Peyton Rouse's personality. Bulldoggish, persuasive, and inflexible, Rouse had acquired a near paternal attachment to his virus, and he was unwilling to capitulate to any other theory of cause. He acknowledged that epidemiologists had shown that exogenous carcinogens were correlated with cancer. Dahl and Hill's study, published in 1950, had clearly shown that smoking was associated with an increase in lung cancer, but this had not offered any mechanistic explanation of cancer causation. Viruses, Rouse felt, were the only answer. By the early 1950s, cancer researchers had thus split into three feuding camps. The virologists, led by Rouse, claimed that viruses caused cancer, although no such virus had been found in human studies. Epidemiologists, such as Dahl and Hill, argued that exogenous chemicals caused cancer, although they could not offer a mechanistic explanation for their theory or results. The third camp, of Theodore Boveri's successors, stood at the farthest periphery. They possessed weak, circumstantial evidence that genes internal to the cell might cause cancer, but had neither the powerful human data of the epidemiologists nor the exquisite experimental insights of the chicken virologists. Great science emerges out of great contradiction, and here was a gaping rift slicing its way through the center of cancer biology. Was human cancer caused by an infectious agent? Was it caused by an exogenous chemical? Was it caused by an internal gene? How could the three groups of scientists have examined the same elephant and returned with such radically variant opinions about its essential anatomy? In 1951, a young virologist named Howard Temin, then a postdoctoral researcher, arrived at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, California, to study the genetics of fruit flies. Restless and imaginative, Temin soon grew bored with fruit flies. Switching fields, he chose to study Rouse sarcoma virus in Renato Dulbecco's laboratory. Dulbecco, a suave, exquisitely mannered Calabrian aristocrat, ran his lab at Caltech with a distant and faintly patrician air. Temin was a perfect fit. If Dulbecco wanted distance, Temin wanted independence. Temin found a house in Pasadena with several other young scientists, including John Cairns, the future author of the Scientific American article on the war on cancer, and spent his time cooking up unusual meals in heavy communal pots and talking volubly about biological riddles late into the night. In the laboratory, too, Temin was cooking up an unusual experiment that was virtually guaranteed to fail. Until the late 50s, Rous sarcoma virus had been shown to cause tumors only in live chickens. Temin, working closely with Harry Rubin, wanted to study how the virus converted normal cells into cancer cells. To do this, they needed a vastly simplified system, a system free of chickens and tumors, and analogous to bacteria in a petri dish. And so Temin imagined creating cancer in a petri dish. In 1958, in his seventh year in Dulbecko's lab, Temin succeeded. He added Rous sarcoma virus to a layer of normal cells in a petri dish. The infection of the cells incited them to grow uncontrollably, forcing them to form tiny distorted heaps containing hundreds of cells that Temin called foci, the plural of focus. The foci, Temin reasoned, represented cancer distilled into its essential elemental form. Cells growing uncontrollably, unstoppably. Pathological mitosis. It was the sheer driving power of Temin's imagination that allowed him to look at a tiny heap of cells and reimagine that heap as the essence of the diffuse systemic disease that kills humans. But Temin believed that the cell and its interaction with the virus had all the biological components necessary to drive the malignant process. The ghost was out of the organism. Temin could now use his cancer in a dish to perform experiments that would have been nearly impossible using whole animals. One of his first experiments with this system, performed in 1959, produced an unexpected result. Normally, viruses infect cells, produce more viruses, and infect more cells, but they do not directly affect the genetic makeup, the DNA, of the cell. Influenza virus, for instance, infects lung cells and produces more influenza virus. But it does not leave a permanent fingerprint in our genes. When the virus goes away, our DNA is left untouched. But Rous's virus behaved differently. Rous sarcoma virus, having infected the cells, had physically attached itself to the cell's DNA and thereby altered the cell's genetic makeup, its genome. The virus, in some structural as well as functional sense, becomes part of the genome of the cell, Temin wrote. Temin's statement was speculative, but it bore his unerring biological instinct. Formal proof of the structural attachment of RSV genes into the cellular genome would only come years later. This observation, that a DNA copy of a virus's genes could structurally attach itself to a cell's genes, intrigued Temin and Dulbecko. But it raised an even more intriguing conceptual problem. In viruses, genes are sometimes carried in their intermediary RNA form. Certain viruses have dispensed with the original DNA copy of genes and keep their genome in the RNA form, which is directly translated into viral proteins once the virus infects a cell. Temin knew from work performed by other researchers that Rous sarcoma virus is one such RNA virus. But if the virus genes started as RNA, then how could a copy of its genes convert into DNA? The central dogma of molecular biology forbade such a transition. Biological information, the dogma proposed, only travels down a one-way street from DNA to RNA to proteins. How on earth, Temin wondered, could RNA turn around acrobatically and make a DNA copy of itself, driving the wrong way down the one-way street of biological information? Temin made a leap of faith. If the data did not fit the dogma, then the dogma, not the data, needed to be changed. He postulated that Rous sarcoma virus carried a special property, a property unprecedented in any other living organism. It could convert RNA back into DNA. In normal cells, the conversion of DNA into RNA is called transcription. The virus, or the infected cell, therefore had to possess the reverse capacity, reverse transcription. Temin had an inkling, but his proof was so circumstantial, so frail, that he could barely convince anyone, the virologist Michael Bishop recalled 25 years later. The hypothesis had earned him little but ridicule and grief. At first, Temin could barely even convince himself. He had made a bold proposition, but he needed proof. In 1960, determined to find experimental proof, Temin moved his lab to the McArdle Laboratory in Wisconsin. Madison, unlike Caltech, was a frozen, faraway place, isolated both physically and intellectually. But this suited Temin. Standing unknowingly at the edge of a molecular revolution, he wanted silence. On his daily walk along Lakeshore Path, often blanketed in dense snow, Temin planned experiments to find evidence for this reverse flow of information. RNA into DNA. Even the thought had made him shiver. A molecule that could write history backward, turn back the relentless forward flow of biological information. To prove that such a process existed, Temin would need to isolate in a test tube the viral enzyme that could reverse transcription and prove that it could make a DNA copy out of RNA. In the early 1960s, pursuing the enzyme, he hired a Japanese postdoctoral student named Satoshi Mizutani. Mizutani's task was to purify this reverse transcription enzyme from virus-infected cells. Mizutani was a catastrophe. Never a cell biologist at heart, as a colleague recalled, he contaminated the cells, infected the cultures, and grew out balls of fungi in the petri dishes. Frustrated, Temin moved Mizutani to a project involving no cells. If Mizutani couldn't manipulate cells, he could try to purify the enzyme out of chemical extracts made from virus-infected cells. The move played to Mizutani's natural skills. He was an incredibly gifted chemist. Overnight, he picked up a weak, flickering enzymatic activity in the cellular extracts of the Rous virus that was capable of converting RNA into DNA. When he added RNA to this cellular extract, he could see it creating a DNA copy, reversing transcription. Temin had his proof. Rous sarcoma virus was no ordinary virus. It could write genetic information backward. It was a retrovirus. The term retrovirus was coined later by virologists. At MIT in Boston, another young virologist, David Baltimore, had also picked up the hint of an RNA to DNA conversion activity, although in a different retrovirus. Brilliant, brash, and single-minded, Baltimore had met and befriended Howard Temin in the 1940s at Science Summer Camp in Maine, where Temin had been a teaching assistant and Baltimore a student. They had parted ways for nearly a decade, yet their intellectual paths had kept crisscrossing. As Temin was exploring reverse transcription in Rous sarcoma virus in Madison, Baltimore had begun to amass evidence that his retrovirus also possessed an enzyme that could convert RNA into DNA. He, too, was steps away from isolating the enzyme. On the afternoon of May 27, 1970, a few weeks after he had found initial evidence for the RNA to DNA converting enzyme in his lab, Temin caught a flight to Houston to present his work at the 10th International Cancer Congress. The next morning, he walked to the cavernous auditorium at the Houston Civic Center. Temin's talk was entitled The Role of DNA in the Replication of RNA Viruses, a title left intentionally bland. It was a short, 15-minute session. The room was filled mainly with tumor virus specialists, many already dozing off to sleep. But as Temin began to unfold his findings, the importance of his talk dawned on the audience. On the surface, as one researcher recalled, it was all very dry biochemistry. Temin spoke in his usual nasal, high-pitched monotone, giving no indication of excitement. But the significance of the work crystallized out of the dry biochemical monotone. Temin was not just talking about viruses. He was systematically dismantling one of the fundamental principles of biology. His listeners became restive, unnerved. By the time Temin reached the middle of the talk, there was an awe-struck silence. Scientists in the audience were feverishly taking notes, filling page after page with harrowed scribbles. Once outside the conference room, Temin recalled, you could see people on the telephone. People called people in their laboratories. Temin's announcement that he had identified the long-sought-after enzyme activity in the virus-infected cells left little doubt about the theory. RNA could generate DNA. A cancer-causing virus's genome could become a physical part of a cell's genes. Temin returned to Madison the next morning to find his laboratory inundated with phone messages. The most urgent of these was from David Baltimore, who had heard an inkling of Temin's news from the meeting. Temin called him back. You know there is an enzyme in the virus particles, Baltimore said. I know, said Temin. Baltimore, who had kept his own work very, very quiet, was stunned. How do you know? We found it. Baltimore had also found it. He too had identified the RNA to DNA enzymatic activity from the virus particles. Each laboratory, working apart, had converged on the same result. Temin and Baltimore both rushed their observations to publication. Their twin reports appeared back to back in Nature magazine in the summer of 1970. In their respective papers, Temin and Baltimore proposed a radical new theory about the life cycle of retroviruses. The genes of retroviruses, they postulated, exist as RNA outside cells. When these RNA viruses infect cells, they make a DNA copy of their genes and attach this copy to the cell's genes. This DNA copy, called a provirus, makes RNA copies, and the virus is regenerated, phoenix-like, to form new viruses. The virus is thus constantly shuttling states, rising from the cellular genome and falling in again. RNA to DNA to RNA. RNA to DNA to RNA. Ad infinitum. It is surely a sign of the prevailing schizophrenia of the time that Temin's work was instantly embraced as a possible mechanistic explanation for cancer by cancer scientists, but largely ignored by clinical oncologists. Temin's presentation in Houston was part of a mammoth meeting on cancer. Both Farber and Fry had flown in from Boston to attend. Yet the conference epitomized the virtually insurmountable segregation between cancer therapy and cancer science. Chemotherapy and surgery were discussed in one room. Viral carcinogenesis was discussed in another. It was as if a sealed divider had been constructed through the middle of the world of cancer, with cause on one side and cure on the other. Few scientists or clinical oncologists crossed between the two isolated worlds. Fry and Farber returned to Boston with no significant change in the trajectories of their thoughts about curing cancer. Yet for some scientists attending the conference, Temin's work, pushed to its logical extreme, suggested a powerful mechanistic explanation for cancer, and thus a well-defined path toward a cure. Saul Spiegelman, a Columbia University virologist known for his incendiary enthusiasm and relentless energy, heard Temin's talk and instantly built a monumental theory out of it, a theory so fiercely logical that Spiegelman could almost conjure it into reality. Temin had suggested that an RNA virus could enter a cell, make a DNA copy of its genes, and attach itself to a cell's genome. Spiegelman was convinced that this process, through a yet unknown mechanism, could activate a viral gene. That activated viral gene must induce the infected cell to proliferate, unleashing pathological mitosis, cancer. It was a tantalizingly attractive explanation. Rouse's viral theory of the origin of cancer would fuse with Boveri's internal genetic theory. The virus, Temin had shown, could become an endogenous element attached to a cell's genes, and thus both an internal aberration and an exogenous infection would be responsible for cancer. Spiegelman's conversion to the new religion of cancer viruses took only minutes, Robert Weinberg, the MIT cancer biologist, recalled. The next day, after Temin's conference, he was back in his lab at Columbia University in New York City, setting up a repeat of the work. Spiegelman raced off to prove that retroviruses caused human cancers. It became his single-minded preoccupation, Weinberg recalled. The obsession bore fruit quickly. For Spiegelman's schema to work, he would need to prove that human cancers had retrovirus genes hidden inside them. Working fast and hard, Spiegelman found traces of retroviruses in human leukemia, in breast cancer, lymphomas, sarcomas, brain tumors, melanomas, in nearly every human cancer that he examined. The Special Virus Cancer Program, launched in the 1950s to hunt for human cancer viruses, and moribund for two decades, was swiftly resuscitated. Here, at long last, were the thousands of cancer viruses that it had so long waited to discover. Money poured into Spiegelman's lab from the SVCP's coffers. It was a perfect folie à deux, endless funds fueling limitless enthusiasm, and vice versa. The more Spiegelman looked for retroviruses in cancer cells, the more he found, and the more funds were sent his way. In the end, though, Spiegelman's effort turned out to be systematically flawed. In his frenzied hunt for human cancer retroviruses, Spiegelman had pushed the virus detection test so hard that he saw viruses or traces of viruses that did not exist. When other labs around the nation tried to replicate the work in the mid-1970s, Spiegelman's viruses were nowhere to be found. Only one human cancer, it turned out, was caused by a human retrovirus, a rare leukemia endemic in some parts of the Caribbean. The hoped-for human virus slipped quietly away into the night, Weinberg wrote. The hundreds of millions of dollars spent by the SVCP could not make it happen. The rocket never left its launching pad. Spiegelman's conjecture about human retroviruses was half right and half wrong. He was looking for the right kind of virus, but in the wrong kind of cell. Retroviruses would turn out to be the cause of a different disease, not cancer. Spiegelman died in 1983 of pancreatic cancer, having heard of a strange illness erupting among gay men and blood transfusion recipients in New York and San Francisco. 1 year after Saul Spiegelman's death in New York, the cause of that disease was finally identified. It was a human retrovirus called HIV. The Hunting of the Sark. For the snark was a boojum, you see. Lewis Carroll. Saul Spiegelman had got hopelessly lost hunting for cancer-causing retroviruses in humans. His predicament was symptomatic. Cancer biology, the NCI, and the targeted Special Virus Cancer Program had all banked so ardently on the existence of human cancer retroviruses in the early 1970s that when the viruses failed to materialize, it was as if some essential part of their identity or imagination had been amputated. If human cancer retroviruses did not exist, then human cancers must be caused by some other mysterious mechanism. The pendulum having swung sharply toward an infectious viral cause of cancer, swung just as sharply away. Temin, too, had dismissed retroviruses as the causal agents for human cancer by the mid-1970s. His discovery of reverse transcription had certainly overturned the dogma of cellular biology, but it had not pushed the understanding of human carcinogenesis far. Viral genes could attach themselves to cellular genes, Temin knew, but this could not explain how viruses caused cancer. Faced with yet another discrepancy between theory and data, Temin proposed another bold conjecture, again standing on the thinnest foundation of evidence. Spiegelman and the retrovirus hunters, Temin argued, had conflated analogy with fact, confused messenger with message. Rouse sarcoma virus could cause cancer by inserting a viral gene into cells. This proved that genetic alterations could cause cancer. But the genetic alteration, Temin proposed, need not originate in a virus. The virus had merely brought a message into a cell. To understand the genesis of cancer, it was that culprit message, not the messenger, that needed to be identified. Cancer virus hunters needed to return to their lamplit virus again, but this time with new questions. What was the viral gene that had unleashed pathological mitosis in cells? And how was that gene related to an internal mutation in the cell? In the 1970s, several laboratories began to hone in on that gene. Fortuitously, RSV possesses only four genes in its genome. In California, by then the hotbed of cancer virus research, the virologists Steve Martin, Peter Vogt, and Peter Duisberg made mutants of the Rouse virus that replicated normally, but could no longer create tumors, suggesting that the tumor-causing gene had been disrupted. By analyzing the genes altered in these mutant viruses, these groups finally pinpointed RSV's cancer-causing ability to a single gene in the virus. The gene was called SRC, pronounced SARC, a diminutive of sarcoma. SARC, then, was the answer to Temin's puzzle, the cancer-causing message borne by Rouse sarcoma virus. Vogt and Duisberg removed or inactivated SARC from the virus and demonstrated that the SARC-less virus could neither induce cell proliferation nor cause transformation. SARC, they speculated, was some sort of malformed gene acquired by RSV during its evolution and introduced into normal cells. It was termed an oncogene, a gene capable of causing cancer. The term oncogene had been coined earlier by two NCI scientists, Robert Huebner and George Todaro, in 1969, although on scant evidence. A chance discovery in Ray Erickson's laboratory at the University of Colorado further elucidated SARC's function. Erickson had been a graduate student in Madison in the early 1960s when Temin had found retroviruses. Erickson had followed the discovery of the SARC gene in California and had been haunted by the function of SARC ever since. In 1977, working with Mark Collette and Joan Brugge, Erickson set out to decipher the function of SARC. SARC, Erickson discovered, was an unusual gene. It encoded a protein whose most prominent function was to modify other proteins by attaching a small chemical, a phosphate group, to these proteins, in essence, playing an elaborate game of molecular tag. Art Levinson, in Mike Bishop's lab at UCSF, also discovered this phosphorylating activity. Indeed, scientists had found a number of similar proteins in normal cells, enzymes that attached phosphate groups to other proteins. These enzymes were called the kinases, and they were soon found to behave as molecular master switches within a cell. The attachment of the phosphate group to a protein acted like an on switch, activating the protein's function. Often, a kinase turned on another kinase, which turned on another kinase, and so forth. The signal was amplified at each step of the chain reaction, until many such molecular switches were thrown into their on positions. The confluence of many such activated switches produced a powerful internal signal to a cell.